I think it's just going to get weirder and weirder and weirder, and finally it's going to be so weird that people are going to have to talk about how weird it is.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today my guest is James Corbett. I've got great upcoming guests like D-Dunking Dan, Guy Anderson, Chance Garten, and John O'Connor. Be on the lookout for those. Check out my films, Occult Louisiana is available on Tubi. Doors of Perception is on Amazon Prime. We are booking guests for June. If you have suggestions or you'd like to be a guest, email me, forbiddenknowledgenews@gmail.com. Today, I want to welcome back to the show James Corbett. He is an author, journalist, and curator of the Corbett Report. James, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for coming back on. Really looking forward to our discussion. We really are in the land of confusion. When I first started to wake up over a decade ago, I never thought about what it would be like if the quote-unquote truth community became just another co-opted psychological operation. But here we are. We're in the middle of the post-truth, choose-your-own-adventure, mass psychosis, algorithm-driven techno-slavery nightmare. Every week, we're presented new opportunities to be assimilated to the Borg. And even our own president has embraced the art of meme warfare and gaslighting on an epic scale. But today, we'll once again share your observations and insights about our crumbling reality. Before we do, remind the audience just a little bit about yourself and let them know how they can find out more.
Sure. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. I've been doing this for 19 years now. I started back in 2007. So I do a podcast and write articles and do interviews on pretty much everything under the sun or anything that interests me, including, of course, science and politics and geopolitics and history and philosophy and everything else. And although, yes, I certainly never knew the exact form that everything was going to take, the fact that the conspiracy reality community has been so thoroughly infiltrated and taken over is not particularly surprising to me. I've been watching it happen for decades now.
And there are a few different aspects to that part of what's happening. But before we get to that, since we last spoke, the big news, of course, is the Epstein files amongst this community. But it's just another demoralizing disappointment. We don't see any justice coming from it. You can look at the information and you would think that there is more than enough to at least start dozens of investigations on these horrible monsters. Yet nothing's happening. People are more interested in UFOs now. It's just another one of those things that hits the memory hole, then we don't ever go back to it and there's never anything done about it. But as far as that goes, do you have any particular interesting observations about the information that came out?
I have an interesting observation about the way you framed that, because you started out by saying the big news amongst our crowd. But in fact, is it the big news? Because as you correctly pointed out a bit further on, no, I don't think it is the big news anymore, because now we're talking about whatever, Iran or UFOs or whatever else is the flavor of the week. And this goes back to something that I identified, I believe, back in 2024, at the end of 2024. I did my year-end edition of New World Next Week with James Evan Pilato at MediaMonarchy.com, where we pick a story of the year and a story and a trend for next year. And my story of the year for 2024 was, I believe, the 60-24 news cycle, because we all know about the 24/7 news cycle invented by none other than recently dearly departed Ted Turner, who started CNN back in 1980 as the 24/7 news network. And that conditioned and habituated people to expect that at absolutely any time of day or night, you're up at 3 a.m, guess what? There is some sort of news that you can tune into, and there will be an announcer and a broadcaster there telling you what's what. What an amazing and wonderful invention. Of course, one of the things that precipitated was the dawn of the era of the talking head, in which you have endless, a never-ending stream of people who are brought onto these types of programs to prevaricate for any length of time on subjects that they dimly understand or perhaps don't understand at all, and it's all opinion all the time. And so that did transform our concept of what news was. But it's even worse now, because now it's not the 24/7 news cycle. It's the 60/24, as in every single minute of every single day, there is a new news cycle that is taking place on whatever social media app you have fallen down into the rabbit hole of, whether that's X or anything else. You have the infinite scroll feed, which, of course, was tailored to precisely play with your brain chemistry and to make sure that you become addicted to that never-ending scroll, the doom scroll, as it is called. And that has so fundamentally fractured our attention to the point where people, I think, are increasingly incapable of devoting concentrated thought to any particular area. And what is one adjunct of that? Well, the Epstein files. Yeah, absolutely. In any other era of certainly the time I've been doing this, or presumably for the modern era of political history, would have been the biggest story of all time. We'd be still talking about it, dissecting it, going through and finding all of the nuggets in the files. But here we are just a couple of months later, and it's like, whatever. And it's funny because the immediate reaction when the files first dropped, and I saw this in my own audience when I dared to talk about it, and hey guys, there's some files here, I think there's something that's worth looking at. The immediate response from certain sectors of the so-called conspiracy reality community was, it's a psyop. You know, why would they release it? So there's nothing there. And that, to me, is the mission accomplished of William Casey, ex-director of the CIA, who famously, infamously remarked that we'll know that our misinformation campaign is complete when everything the American public believes is false. As we record this, I am in the midst of writing an editorial on the CIA One, because what people think that that phrase from William Casey means is that the CIA is just going to flood everything with disinformation. But I'm the smart one who sees through it all. So I, you know, don't worry, guys. I'll tell you what's what. But in reality, I think what that was really gesturing towards was not that everything that you believe is false. It's that you believe everything is false, as in you don't believe in any truth. There is no truth that comes from any source. So as soon as the Epstein files drop, it's a psyop. Don't look at it. As soon as anything happens, Iran is a distraction that was sent. It has no meaning in and of itself. It was just a distraction from Epstein. And now UFOs are a distraction from Iran. And the next story is a distraction from that story. And the next story, and nothing has any meaning. Nothing has any truth. And that is the point. That is the way they are breaking down what was, I think, a genuine independent media revolution that took place at the dawn of the 21st century that truly did threaten the information paradigm that had been built up in the old oligopolistic media empire of the late 20th century. How are we going to put the cork back in the bottle? Oh, no, we don't put the cork back in the bottle. We smash the bottle and release everything. Everything goes out. And you have fun sorting it out for yourselves, guys. And meanwhile, everyone's pointing fingers at each other going, agent, 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 you're an agent, you're a psyop. Yeah. This is not true. This is not real. So there is no such thing as reality. And once we hit that nadir, what are you going to do? And then into that maelstrom, they send the AI slop phenomenon. So now, guaranteed, if the dead internet theory was just a fun theory a few years ago, it is stone cold reality now. 99% of everything that you're going to encounter from this point out is generated AI slop. So good luck sorting that one out, guys. That is how they win, not just to divide and conquer on a political scale, but on the information, on the epistemological scale, so that every single person becomes a completely isolated unit of one. I know the truth. I see through all the lies, and everyone else is an agent. Everything else is a psyop.
On one hand, it seems like they want a certain group of people to be aware of how deep the rabbit hole goes, to be aware of how corrupt the system is. But at the same time, we've reached a point where if you have eyes to see any of this stuff, you almost want to check out of it all, because you can't tell what's real, what isn't, what is a psychological operation, what's theater, who's a political actor and who isn't. Is that what they wanted? Was the conspiracy truth movement part of the bigger picture all along? Did they have precognition of the way things would roll out as they did?
I think there are two ways of looking at this. One is that absolutely everything, including your own questioning of the lies that we've been fed all our lives, is part of the grand plan of the conspirators, because they have you all planned 17 ways from Sunday and years, decades, generations in advance. They know exactly every step of the program, and they're releasing it all at the exact right time to steer you in exactly whatever direction they want. And if that is the case, then what is the point? Why are you talking to me? Why am I talking to you? Why are we doing absolutely any of this? I do not believe in that level of conspiracy, that literally everything that happens is planned. It's all a psyop. It's all been planned in advance. The fact that you are waking up is part of their plan, et cetera, is enemy propaganda. It is designed to get you to lie down, think that they control absolutely everything, so nothing I can do could possibly matter, lie down and die. And if you accept that, then they have won. I refuse to accept that. So what is the alternative? Well, I think the alternative corresponds to the reality that we know. Yes, certainly, absolutely anything that happens, they can steer towards their agenda. But that doesn't talk about their manipulation of everything that happens. It's the manipulation that comes along after the fact to steer it into an agenda. But with that insight, we can use that for our purposes. For example, if we are interested in, say, human freedom, then we can take absolutely every problem that happens and go, look, see, if we had freedom, that wouldn't have happened. Whereas they come along and say, hey, look, this bad thing that happened, it's because you had too much freedom. Well, that's just their spin on it. And we can remove that spin and put the reality of it out there. We can use this to our advantage. But too many people are caught up in the psyop of they plan everything. And everything there, you can't do anything to them. So, and they never complete that sentence, but the sentence is completed by saying, so don't do anything. And that is the psyop.
On one hand, there's also the fact that more and more people are becoming aware of the corruption as it unfolds. It's like they're not even trying to hide anything anymore. They are just throwing it all out there. It's like they know that they're untouchable in a sense. How are we supposed to navigate even something, for example, what just happened with Thomas Massie? We know that the elections are rigged. Some people had a glimmer of hope with Thomas Massie and what he was presenting, but you look at what happened again today with that election, obviously stolen. Are we supposed to give up voting altogether? Where are we supposed to go next now that the jig is up and most people are aware of the corruption?
Excellent question. And for people who are still trapped in the myth of political authority, because it is a myth that has been implanted into your mind that makes you believe that because of some legitimation process, and that process changes in different locales and different time periods, but some sort of magic ritual of putting pieces of paper in a box and them counting those pieces of paper gives other human beings special rights and privileges, which average people don't. And they get to have certain titles and sit in certain fancy offices and write laws that then become the law of the land, which, of course, none of which corresponds with actual reality, which is based on natural law, and which has corresponded to, for example, the common law system from which the modern system has, which the modern system has completely perverted. And there's a lot to say with regards to that. But I think one of the important parts of the understanding of, okay, at the very least, people are waking up to the fact that writing your suggestion and putting it in the slave suggestion box isn't going to be the fundamental solution that people are looking for. So what is the fundamental solution? Yes, I dare say, and I say it loudly and proudly, that as an anarchist, no, I do not think that voting, you're going to vote your way to freedom, or that you are going to vote for some political puppet to come along to save you from the problems that are being created by the political puppets. That is not how reality works. But once you come to that realization, yes, what is the solution? Well, of course, the solution that has been arrived at independently by generation after generation throughout all of human history has been revolution. And unfortunately, of course, we do see the ways that revolutions are steered and manipulated and brought back into some sort of controlled reality and are used as the steam valves to let people have some bit of steam off or to fundamentally change the nature of the game, but in a way that's still controlled by the oligopoly. So we can look at various revolutions that have taken place throughout history and what has resulted from them. Like, look at the French Revolution. Yes, of course. Again, that was steered, manipulated, instituted for a certain agenda in a certain way. But you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and say Louis XVI wasn't part of that agenda. Yeah, genuine heads roll, genuine people who believe themselves to be at the top of the hierarchy, or at least if safely ensconced in the oligarchy, will have their heads chopped off. There will be times of bloodshed and mayhem. And then they come along and put the pieces together in a way that satisfies people for that new time period and to move them into the next stage of the agenda. So, yes, the question is, is there such a thing as a revolution that actually accomplishes anything? And politically speaking, again, I'm sorry, but I don't think that is the case. If there is any political revolution throughout all of human history that I could even sort of get behind, at least in terms of some of the rhetoric and some of the ideas that were being put on the table, I would say, yeah, the American Revolution sounded good from certain perspectives, certain people who articulated that idea of human freedom in certain ways based on going back to the tradition of people like John Locke, but then reformulated in the Declaration of Independence, etc. Beautiful, stirring words about human freedom, etc. And what has been the result of that? And really, truly, some incredibly smart people talking and writing these great letters back and forth to each other and editorials and all these, the genuine work and genuine historical perspective that went into how do we found a republic that will actually last. And these people were not naive. They were students of history who had studied the Roman Republic and how it fell into the Roman Empire, etc. And we have to have checks and balances, and we have to have this system, etc., etc. And what resulted from that? The greatest world empire that the world has ever seen, the most incredibly brutal, offensive tyranny that absolutely violates absolutely every single one of the edicts of those American revolutionaries from the 18th century. So that is the end result of what could have been the greatest political revolution, right? So, I'd venture to say that a political revolution is going to lead us in some way back to the spot that we were in, or in an even worse spot. So then again, the question poses itself yet again, what is the solution? Is there a revolution that can actually make a difference? And I am still formulating my thoughts on that. But in the course of a recent podcast for my Film Literature in the New World Order podcast, I was reading Powerless by Harry Turtledove. And as part of that, it's science fiction. It's up for the Libertarian Futurist Society's Prometheus Award this year. It's a finalist for that award because it fits into the broad category of freedom-based science fiction. But it's an alternative history, essentially. What if the Russians essentially won the Cold War? Something along those lines. And so America in this fictional world is a communist America. And anyway, it's a fascinating story. I enjoyed it. You can watch my conversation with John C.A. Manley on that on the Film Literature in the New World Order podcast. But that novel was based on the essay written by Václav Havel, the Czech dissident from behind the Iron Curtain, who wrote this Power of the Powerless essay back in the 1970s about the question of revolution, obviously in that time, in that context, the revolution, the potential for a revolution within the Soviet Union and what that would look like and what that means. And he writes in a very, very interesting and obviously philosophically informed manner about this subject and how it is not just a question of a political reordering of society, because this is not a purely simply political problem that people are faced with. Rather, the ideology of the post-totalitarian state, as he calls it, not post-totalitarian as in after totalitarian, but a different type of totalitarian, sort of the new form of totalitarianism that he was confronting and identifying. The form of that is not simply a political form. It is an ideological But it's even beyond the ideological. It goes down into the social fabric. And there's this entire social fabric that is woven out of these lived experiences of all of these people who are playing this kind of game of ideology and power, etc. And it's a very interesting insight. But he eventually comes to the realization that the only revolution that will actually affect the conditions of society at that point is the existential revolution. And what is an existential revolution and how does that work? Well, that, again, as I say, I'm still formulating my thoughts on that. I will definitely have more to say about that in the future, but it certainly lines up with what I've been saying basically since the start of the Corbett Report. The only revolution that matters is the revolution that takes place between your ears. That is the only one that can fundamentally change the world. You can vote all you want for whatever political institution you want, but if it is still guided by the same fundamentally flawed ideology, it will arrive at the same place as we started off from. So that is my gesture towards what we have to work towards, an existential revolution that completely changes our perception of ourselves and our place in the universe, etc. Easier said than done, I realize, but anything less than that is just going to be part of this game.
Right on. I love that existential revolution. Let's get your thoughts on AI, the emerging surveillance state, the emerging data centers, and how we can navigate the future as these things emerge. I look around my own town and I can see the emerging surveillance, streetlight cameras everywhere, flock cameras coming on. What are your thoughts on how to navigate this? And is there anything that we can do on an individual basis to combat this?
Okay, excellent and important questions. And if people want to hear my thoughts on this in greater detail, they can go to a recent Solutions Watch that I released on Butlerian Jihad When, which takes its cue from an interesting factoid that I saw, as you might have seen that recent story about some crazy guy went to Sam Altman's house with a Molotov cocktail and threw the Molotov cocktail. It damaged nothing. It killed no one. It was not a real threat. But anyway, this crazy guy went there because, specifically, of course, he wants violence and bloodshed, some sort of revolution against the AI, the would-be AI overlords. But the interesting point that jumped out at me right away was that apparently he went by the moniker Butlerian Jihadist. And immediately I thought, Butlerian Jihadist? I know that because I have read Frank Herbert's Dune. And for people who have not read Dune, the Butlerian Jihad is something that took place in the distant past of the Dune universe, but the Dune universe is in the very far future, so it's in our future. At some point, there is the Butlerian Jihad, essentially, and it's only alluded to in the Dune novel, the original Dune novel, so there's not a lot of detail there, but at some point, there were thinking machines that... Now, there's actually some detail and some nuance to the way that he frames this. Basically, people were using machines to rule other people, but that kind of gets excluded. Anyway, long story short, there are thinking machines, AI, something, whatever, robots, that at some point essentially enslave humanity. And there is a Butlerian Jihad led by someone named Butler who overthrows the thinking machines, right? And that becomes a core part of the Dune mythology, because that's where they get their the edict that becomes this literally religious doctrine by the point of the Dune novels, that you shall not make a machine in the likeness of a man's mind, as in you should not make thinking machines. And that becomes this religious doctrinal point by the point of the Dune universe. And that's why there are no talking robots. This is very far in the future, but all the machines are just machines. And that's because of this important part of the mythology. Anyway, so apparently this crazy Molotov cocktail guy was at least motivated by that enough to adopt the name Butlerian Jihad. But it does raise the question, at what point does our opposition to the thinking machines that are now coming online, at what point does that become a genuine revolutionary moment or a jihadist moment where there is some sort of religious uprising against it that engages in genuine violence, genuine acts of violence, etc.? Well, I think to one extent, you could say that we are being prepped for that. If you were looking at it in a PSYOP kind of manner, certainly you saw Larry Fink recently coming out talking about these incredibly large, you know, billion-dollar data center developments and the investment that is going into building out the data center infrastructure. But you could take it out with a $3,000 drone. And he said it's not just Russia or China or Iran who could do that. It could be domestic terrorists. So seeding that idea into the public consciousness. And, of course, we saw recently Kevin O'Leary, Canadian billionaire Kevin O'Leary, calling out those Utah citizens who dared to stand up against a data center project that he's investing in, calling them out by name on Fox News, saying, you know, I think these guys are being funded by the Chinese Communist Party. So clearly, I think we are being set up to expect and to see some large scale act, some at the very least, some sort of large scale and very photogenic, videogenic act of terror or would-be terror regarding a data center that could then be very quickly spun into a narrative of, hey, look, see, I knew there were domestic terrorists out there and we have to crack down on anyone who would join this new butlerian jihad, or is it a neo-Luddite movement? And in that Solutions Watch episode that, again, I think people should check out, Butlerian Jihad When, I also go through the recently released book by Brian Merchant called Blood in the Machines. And it is a study of the history of specifically around 1811, 1812, the development of the Luddite movement in England specifically, and what that movement was, where it came from, what it was motivated by, how it developed, and how it was ultimately crushed, to the point that, to the extent that anyone in modern times knows or remembers the Luddite name, it is only as, obviously, a pejorative that's thrown out. It generally is referring to someone who is doomed to fail in the fight against the progress of technology, and slightly stupid. Oh, he's a Luddite. You know, he just doesn't get it. He's, you know, whatever. He's going to be gone tomorrow. But Brian Merchant, in drawing out the actual history of the real Luddite movement, which was a real, not just a machine smashing movement, although that was part of what they were doing, but it was a genuine social movement that was predicated on the labor relations that were taking place at that time in that socio-political context. It had genuine meaning and was a genuine threat to the system, which was why it had to be not just put down, but turned into that pejorative. So that by now, if you go to the bastion of truth, Wikipedia or Google or whatever that people, the joke you normie goes to get their truth, if they just type in the word Luddite, what is Luddite? They'll be happy to tell you, oh, it's some old movement, crazy people who were scared of machines, and they got thoroughly destroyed. And that is all you will hear about them. So I would recommend people who are interested, check out Brian Merchant's book. It puts the Luddite movement in its socio-political context, in historical context, and obviously then connects it to our current times and the growing big tech backlash. Are we on the cusp of some sort of neo-Luddite movement? What does that mean? And what could we learn from the failures of the original Luddite movement that might make this movement actually substantial in terms of, again, it's not necessarily about simply smashing the machines, but about fundamentally rethinking our relations to the would-be ruling elite and the power that they have to, for example, take up the natural resources of the world for their pet data center projects. Who gave them that right? Why do three councilmen in some Utah, you know, county district have the ability to overrule the vast majority of the people living in that district who do not want the data center? What is that? How does that work? If we can start to really fundamentally interrogate those questions, we might come up with some answers that might actually be uncomfortable for power, which is why they do not generally want us asking those questions. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. But I think we are on the cusp of that revolutionary moment, and I think everyone feels it and understands it. The only question is, can it be steered into unproductive ways, or can it be used to actually change, fundamentally change the social fabric of the reality around us?
It's very interesting because it's obvious part of the solution is to check out of their systems as much as possible, build our own parallel systems. But as we do that, they are eating up and destroying more natural resources, infiltrating the new systems that we are building. every step we take, they are a few steps ahead and they're able to co-opt all the good things that we have started to do. So it's going to be interesting to see how we can navigate what is to come with the systems that we are using right now to survive and make a living off of. You take AI, for example. This is taking a lot of people's jobs in many different ways. Also, are the days of video evidence over? What is going to be the future of the entertainment industry? How can we trust anything that we see in media anymore? So many questions surrounding navigating this technological nightmare future.
There absolutely are, and all of them are fascinating. Actually, just, and this may not be the fundamental existential questions that we're dealing with today, but the question of the future of the entertainment industry is not only important to everyone directly employed in that industry or all of the ancillary services employ various other people, but just the question of that actually does get to part of what may be part of that existential revolution that we're talking about. Because really, what is the purpose of the entertainment industry at all? Why does it exist? What is it? What does it do? And if we wanted to go way back and start to look at the roots of, say, the Greek drama and how that evolved and the idea of catharsis and why people go to watch stories of things that aren't real, like why do we care? Well, obviously there is an integral part of the human experience that probably, as people say, go back to the caveman time, sitting around the fire telling stories about the gods or whatever, to keep each other entertained, distracted, or to, in a way, live out those experiences in a mythological form that help to inform the life that we are living and our own character and who we are, shapes who we are as people. There's an important part of our identity that is wrapped up in that. I mean, these are some of the fundamental questions of what it means to be human. And that is actually at stake when we start talking about the AI slop takeover of the entertainment industry, because certainly the entertainment industry as it came to exist in the 20th century and that we grew up with and thus think is the entertainment industry, of course, is completely unrecognizable to people in any other era of human history. It was only enabled by the certain technological advances that had been made to make that industry possible and profitable. And so, of course, the development of the ability to record people's voices obviously gives rise to the recording industry, which obviously did not exist before that point. Before that point, there was a publishing industry, which again was predicated on the printing press idea from the 15th century. But that publishing industry was the music industry of the time. And what that meant was that people would buy books of songs and they would go home and play them and learn them and play them on their piano, and that would be the form of entertainment for people in their physical proximity. And that was how music was distributed. And then the recording industry comes along and completely upends that. And suddenly, not everyone has to know how to play a piano or play an instrument. Suddenly, you can just listen to other people doing it. And that completely transforms people's relationship to music and to the people around them. Now you don't need to be in a community of musicians and people who can perform this music. Now you can be by yourself in a room listening to people recorded halfway around the world. That fundamentally changes the relationship, that the human relationship that was at the base of the musical experience. And now it's being transformed even further, because now, at the very least, in the old 20th century entertainment industry, well, at least someone was playing an instrument somewhere at some point, and they were recorded. And so there was still people who were actually learning how to do this skill, and there were humans that were writing these songs and putting human experience into these song forms and connecting with people that way. And yeah, it's different than the pre-20th century, but still, there was that human experience. Now we're removing the human element from the production of this music. Now it's not necessarily anyone actually knows how to play that piano or that guitar or whatever it is you're hearing. In fact, maybe a human didn't even write those words that you're listening to. Maybe a human didn't sing them. Maybe it's all completely synthetic, being generated by and dreamt up by some AI data god What does that mean about the human experience that defines who we are as human beings, what we are doing at all? What is the point of an entertainment industry that is bot generated? Now the only part of the human equation we have left to remove are the humans who are just imbibing this content. But I think they're working on that as well with the depopulation agenda. Pretty soon, yeah, we won't need humans around to consume the content that's being created by these AI bots. That, to me, is the worrying part of this, is the removal of the human element. This is not just another, you Luddite, you just don't like technological advancement. No, this is a fundamentally, this is not a difference in degree, this is a difference in kind of technological advancement, quote unquote, that will remove the human from the equation altogether. And that to me is the scariest part of all of this, because I know that the real long-term game plan of the would-be Malthusian eugenicist technocratic overlords is the depopulation agenda. Everything, the world's resources for me and my progeny and maybe a few of my friends, and nothing for anyone else. They are slaves on the plantation until such point as we can have robot slaves, and then we can get rid of the real human slaves. And that is the part that we are moving towards. So even something as innocuous as the entertainment industry changeover that's happening right now, it actually speaks to that fundamental question of the existential revolution that needs to happen right now. There is no later.
The illusion of scarcity is a major part of their control system. If you look at what happened with COVID, it started a chain of events with our supply chain and the economy and pricing. You fast forward to the war that we're still dabbling in with Iran and Israel. This had a huge effect, again, on our supply chain and gas prices. It all is starting to build up to a point to where the snowball is rolling down the hill, and it's enormous, and it's about to crash through everything. The collapse of many systems are looming. The COVID, this war, all of the high impact events that have happened within the past few years were essentially to get that snowball rolling so they could destroy these old systems and implant their new technocratic nightmare. Do you think the war is mostly illusionary to perpetuate the crash of these systems?
In a sense, yes, I would agree with that take, depending how it's framed. Just as I said earlier that the only revolution that matters is the revolution between your ears, I think the only war that matters is the war that is taking place for that most important battle space in the world, which is your cognitive terrain, your brain, your mind, what you think and the way you perceive the world. That is what the war is really about. Whatever war we're talking about, whether it's the war on Iran or absolutely any other aspect of the 5G war on everyone, the fifth generation war on everyone that I have identified as the real World War III that we are already engaged in which it is not armies lining up on a battlefield shooting at each other. No, it is essentially every government and ruling structure on the planet against the rest of free humanity. And from that perspective, we see absolutely every aspect of this war on everything taking place all at once, whether it's the economic war, the biological war, the information war, etc. So there's a lot that is happening right now, and it is ultimately about shaping your ideas, your thoughts, your perceptions. And this is a point that I go back to frequently because it's something that I think we all understand, but we never think out what does this mean? We all understand that there is an incredible, overwhelming tidal wave of propaganda that we have been subjected to our entire lives to get us to believe certain things about the world and our place in it. But the corollary of that is that why are they propagandizing us? It is because what we think is important. If what you think has no importance, if you could believe anything and it would still all turn out the same, they would not spend their time and energy and resources propagandizing you. The fact that they spend so much time trying to get you to believe lies means that what you believe actually does matter. It really is important. So going back to the only revolution that matters, that on the individual level, which is the only level that we can directly affect, the individual level, each person has to, at the very least, draw their lines in the cognitive battlefield space and say, here and no further. And whatever lines you decide, in whatever aspect of this fight that you decide, is obviously up for each individual to come to. At what point do you stop taking the plunge into the central bank digital currency or the stablecoin currency or the digital currency space? At what point do you say, no, I will not go any further in this direction? And how do you enforce that? Because once your bank starts requiring that you have a smartphone tracking device so that they can send a code every time you want to log in to your account, because there's no ATMs anymore, there's no bank tellers, now it's all done online, et cetera, you start realizing you have been woven into this technological fabric that brings along with it everything that you don't want. So how do you start carving out a space to be different? And what does that mean? And are you willing to literally die for that? Because at some point, maybe it literally means you can't live in this world anymore. You're going to starve to death if you don't go along with the system. So really, really, truly, where is that line in the sand? And where do you go here and no further? And again, I'm not making that decision for anyone. Obviously, everyone has to make that for themselves. But you did say in passing that the collective action, which always fails, is not going to be what gets us through. Well, that is true, obviously, when we look at the one step forward, 10 steps back of human history in terms of, well, you know, we're so much better now than the outright slaves of yore, or the feudal peasants of yore, or the, you know, the people scrabbling to eke out a meager existence from the soil in, you know, the early forms of capitalism, etc. No, now we're much better off, but we're also actually much more enslaved in our minds, at least to the propaganda system that's been constructed around us. So yes, there's definitely an aspect of we are collectively failing. But again, I would posit that if the idea that there will be no there can be no collective movement, there can be no action outside of ourselves that actually affects positive change in the world, if we accept that, then once again, why are we talking? Why is anyone listening to us? What does any of this mean? Might as well just go lay down and die. So I have to believe that there is the possibility that individuals coming to their own conclusions about their own cognitive battle space and what they are willing and prepared to do within their own domain will be able to find ways to cooperate and work together and not agree on every issue. But you will notice that if there is anything that defines the online space, it is the ultimate divide and conquer space in which people are narrowing themselves further and further and further down into their algorithmic filter bubble so that they are surrounded by people who believe and agree on exactly every point of doctrine that they believe and agree upon, except, wait, we agree on all of this, but you think that? That's it. I'll never talk to you again. You're an idiot. Or you're an agent, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So yes, I think if there is to be some sort of collective movement that has any effect on the real world, it will take place in the real world. It will not take place online, because I think if there's anything we've understood, it is that the online space is a space that just the medium is the message. This isn't about who controls what particular server or platform or who's manipulating this algorithmic feed or the other. It is the nature of the online space itself that it precludes actual human collaboration in the real world. So I don't know about you. I'm not optimistic about the possibility of an online revolution actually changing the real world.
All right. Do you think enough people learned from the COVID operation to not be subjected to the ridiculousness of hantavirus?
Well, I guess we are seeing that experiment play out in real time. And to some extent, maybe that is what the COVID experiment, or at least one aspect of what the COVID experiment was about testing the water for exactly those types of measures and that type of thing. We know that there were psychological operation campaigns that were being waged by governments around the world on their own citizens during that time. And for example, I've talked quite a bit about SpyB, the I'm not going to remember what SPI-B, which was the British propaganda campaign, in which some of the members of that advisory panel that was advising the British government on how to fine-tune their COVID propaganda to make people obey those lockdown orders, etc. Some of the people came out and admitted, well, essentially, these were the exact types of tactics that are used to facilitate torture and or have been used by tyrannical regimes in the past. That is exactly what we were doing, to try to manipulate the public into this. This is by their own admission. So we know that those types of campaigns have been taking place and that they are unfortunately very effective. But of course, that's not just Britain. I've talked to people in Canada, John Carpe, talking about the Canadian version of that. And Americans obviously know about the propaganda campaign that was taking place there, etc. The point is that clearly one aspect of the COVID PSYOP was a gigantic psychological experiment. How can we best get people to go along with this narrative? And 2 weeks to flatten the curve, stay home and save grandma, all of that, where it turned out to be fairly effective, effective enough on enough of the population that the vast majority of the population was willing to, at the very least, go along with it, if not actively believe it in their soul. But who can measure that? Anyway, we can measure compliance, at least in terms of who actually was willing to obey lockdown orders and wear the mask and take the genetic slurry, etc. And so there are hard numbers that the people who run these campaigns have to work with and can further fine-tune their propaganda for the future. So now we see the next iteration of that with hantavirus, etc. I tend to be skeptical that they're going to go and pull the trigger and go all the way with this. When I saw the COVID narrative forming in early 2020, I still refuse to believe, because I'd lived through Zika, I'd lived through Ebola, I'd lived through swine flu and all of these other mini tests of this biosecurity state that had happened in the preceding decade, to the point where I thought this was just going to be another one of those. Yeah, the WHO will, of course, use this as a grift to generate some vaccine sales for their big pharma buddies, and maybe they'll try some of their public health emergency of international concern type powers and that sort of thing. But I didn't think they were going to go all the way until I think the point at which I knew they were actually pulling the trigger on it was when they decided to cancel the rest of the NBA season. I said, they're not going to do that unless they're okay. So they're really going for this one. And that was the point at which I realized this was the next 9/11 that was happening in real time. I have yet to see that with antivirus. I don't believe they're probably going to pull the trigger like that. But again, it's just another data point for what types of messaging works and how can we get people to accept it most effectively. And unfortunately, we're all feeding our data into that in real time, because we're all putting all of our thoughts into the online space to be scraped up and monitored and dissected by the AI algorithmic overlords. So, but what is the solution to that? So we should just not talk to each other online. Well, okay, yeah, agreed. So what are you going to do? How many people do you have in your physical community in reality who you can form the reality bubble with? And unfortunately, probably not a lot. Not a lot of people have that real reality bubble in real life, because again, I look outside and I see all those people who just all believe all the lies. But I go online and I can find some of the people who see through the lies. So I'll stay online, which of course I think is part of the agenda in and of itself. Anyway, the question is it enough? Did enough people see through COVID to be able to come out the other side and see through things like antivirus? Again, I think that's what we're finding out right now. And because we never had the final COVID reckoning, where unfortunately, COVID kind of petered out and it went from masks to Ukrainian flags in the bio pretty quickly. So there was no time or pause for reflection about, oh, we just got had. And most people didn't admit that they were had. They just moved on and kind of pretended it never happened. So until we have that kind of reckoning with what really happened there, I don't think, I would venture to say not enough people learned their lesson in that. But again, we'll find out. We'll find out if people, the real test will be when and if they do pull the trigger and try to go back into lockdown total biosecurity mode. Will people comply with that this time? I would venture to say there would be less people in America who would be inclined to comply. But I'm in Japan, so I don't know if that helps.
I would hope so. A huge part of my awakening was finding a spiritual connection, as it seems to be with many people. But with everything else, spirituality has been infiltrated from all angles. No matter what practice you're trying to find, you'll find your algorithm-sanctioned guru online telling you how to pray or what to believe in or where to take your spiritual practices, and mostly leading you to psychosis. But it seems that the biggest contender in the co-opted spirituality realm is Christianity right now. Is this something that you're seeing as well, this Christianity weaponization and more people kind of flocking to that?
Yes. Obviously, that is a narrative that has been put out there. And there have been variations on this sort of revival narrative and the Gen Z are more religious than their parents and that sort of thing. Has been something that people have been floating. Although I just saw a headline, take it for what it's worth, the other day that, actually it's been disproved because, yeah, it turns out post-COVID attendance at church is down. So not up. So again, there are many ways to dissect all of that information and make of it what you will. I would ask people, instead of looking online for the answers, again, look in your actual real life community. If you go to a church, has attendance increased? Are people more passionate? Are there more young people who are interested in finding answers to this big spiritual questions or not? And come to your own conclusions, perhaps based on reality rather than what people are telling you online. But having said that, yes, that the church and various spiritual practices have been infiltrated and used to steer people for a very long time is certainly no news to anyone who's been paying attention. And specifically in the American context, I'm sure that people who are interested in the subject are familiar with, for example, the Rockefeller infiltration of the church movement in the early 20th century and the development and the preparation for the coming one world religion. There's a lot of cookie crumbs on that trail for people to follow, etc. And of course, again, it's obvious that at any point at which you have something that is powerful and has a powerful effect on the human mind, there are those with nefarious agendas and in mind who are going to use them for nefarious purposes. That should not be surprising to us. In fact, I think that that's probably what, at least part of what Frank Herbert was really gesturing to in Dune. And for this is where you get to the second order of the Butlerian Jihad, because of course it seems fairly straightforward. The thinking machines enslaved the humans overthrew the thinking machines and outlawed thinking machines. But actually, viewed in the context of the Dune story, you find that actually, well, Herbert was really creating this tale, which is brilliant in the way that he does it, where the hero actually turns out to be a variation of the villain and a dictator who you see his rise to that position of tyrant. And he was placed in there by the creation of this elaborate mythology that had been developed for thousands of years by this order of nuns, the Bene Gesserit, who had been seeding this mythology about the coming chosen one, etc., for all this time, and using that to manipulate people, etc. And part of that was predicated on the idea of the Butlerian Jihad and the overthrow of the thinking machines that enslaved humanity. Because remember what I said earlier, it wasn't just thinking machines just started enslaving humans. The way it was phrased specifically was people using machines used those thinking machines to have power over other people. Yes, it was certain people using the technology in a certain way, and then the next order comes along and bans that technology altogether, and what you get is the institution of this feudal system that relies on this trading Choem company that controls essentially the spice and thus the economy of the universe. And so when you actually start to examine it in detail, it's like, oh no, even the Butlerian Jihad might have been, if not at an organic part, at least after the fact, used as the part of the creation of this new order of enslavement of humanity. And it's an organic enslavement of humanity. Yay, question mark. So yes, religious ideas and practices can and absolutely shape people's identities and the way that they act in the world. And thus, of course, are going to be, well, catnip to people who are psychopaths and looking to find ways to manipulate other people.
Yeah. Well, James, I know you have a hard stop at an hour. Do you have any final thoughts about what we discussed tonight and anything interesting upcoming that you'd like to share with the audience?
I don't have final thoughts, but I have ongoing thoughts. And clearly the existential revolution is something that we've touched on here, but haven't even defined, let alone really worked out. So I am going to be putting the thinking cap on and working towards that for, I assume, a future edition of Solutions Watch. Anyway, people can stay tuned at CorbettReport.com as I continue working through these sorts of things in my own mind and for myself, and hopefully by putting it out in the world, other people can benefit from that. But as I say, I think the only revolution that matters is the one that happens between your ears, and then how that affects the real world around you, not the online space. So I think that's where people would more fruitfully be directing their idea, their energy, shall we say.
Excellent. James, thank you so much. We will definitely have to do this again in the future. And until next time, everyone have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow.